Blog Talk Radio.
Big NBA show today. There's nothing else to be said. Fred, I'll be the last time you hear that song on a Sunday morning. This is Real Sports Talk Radio, brought to you or presented to you live from backsportspage.com. My name is Randy Zellia, along with the one and only Mike Tramatazzi. Good morning, Michael.
Hello, Randy. How's it going?
It was like you get that good exciting opening, and then it's like, hey, Randy, what's up, man? Okay, let's lock and load with this.
Get the coffee going. I need to get the coffee going.
Yeah, it's 11 a.m. You want to chime in with us? 760-283-0846. 760-283-0846. 90 minutes of fun sports talk action. I don't know how to find a way to really describe what we do here besides that way, other than to say sports talk radio. Really NBA heavy today. You want to talk about guests? We have guests. We want to break down and do a different perspective on the NBA playoffs. We have the people to do it for you right here today. At 11:15, we have Stephen Kozul from the Chicago Bulls radio team there. He's going to come on and talk about the Brooklyn Nets ending their season last night against the Chicago Bulls in probably one of the most gutsiest performances from Joakim Noah and the rest of the Bulls eliminating Brooklyn last night. At 11:30, straight from West Palm Beach, shock, Sid Rosenberg, former New York and Miami radio host, joining us to help break down the Miami Heat-Chicago Bulls series. And then around 12 p.m., Ethan Skolnick will be live from the Miami Heat practice facility coming on with us to give us a different perspective from the Miami Heat and talk about LeBron James becoming the MVP later on today. So lots to talk about. Like I said, 90 minutes. Real quick, Mike Tramatazzi, if you need to reach Mike on Twitter, you can find him at...
@MTramatazzi.
Okay, and for me, if you need to find me, I finally changed my Twitter handle, RandyBSP. Reminder, starting next week, Ryan Stern owns this time slot for Real Sports Talk Radio, and starting next Friday night, you can catch both Jose and I back on the air together, Real Sports Talk Radio, expanding out to Friday nights from 9:30 to 11:30 p.m., and our first three guests will be announced this upcoming Wednesday. I will tell you, we'll be a little NBA heavy and a little NFL heavy with an ESPN analyst who's been on our show many times before. So if you listen to the show consistently, you know who's on with us. So with all that being said, let's jump into this last night, Michael. 99-93, Chicago over Brooklyn. Joakim Noah steals the show. He lives up to the prediction of winning Game 7. The stat line for Noah, 24 points, 14 boards, 6 block shots. Probably one of the best stat lines I've ever seen for an NBA game. The Bulls shoot 48% from the field. And really, Deron Williams leads Brooklyn with 24 points, 7 assists, and 6 boards. But it was when those points were scored. It felt like a lot of Deron Williams' points came in the first half. He didn't seem like he was very eager to shoot the ball when it really mattered in the second half of the game.
Yeah, I thought the Nets really came out flat in this game. I think maybe they, I don't know if in a Game 7 you can underestimate a team because you've played them 6 times in 2 weeks. So I think underestimate's the wrong word. I just think they didn't match the intensity that the Bulls came with. And PJ mentioned that in the post game. He thought the first half they just didn't match the intensity that Chicago came out with. And the Bulls basically took it to them, especially in that second quarter where the Nets got nothing from their bench. They took it to them in that second quarter, pretty much then just held on in the second half and made just enough plays in the third and fourth quarter, whether it's Bellinelli, obviously Joakim Noah. Boozer had a couple big plays in the fourth quarter. So the Bulls made just enough plays in the second half to stem the tide that the Nets were building and the momentum they had and were able to hold on. But I thought this game, honestly, was probably decided in the second quarter when the Nets just got run by the Bulls. I think it was, what, a 6 or 7 point lead at the end of the first, and then the Bulls just ran past them in the second quarter with big plays from Daquan Cook came in, hit a three. Marcus Teague, I thought, played very key minutes, even though he didn't contribute a lot. What he did contribute was not just 4 points, but he also allowed Nate Robinson to not get overworked and was able to rest. They were able to rest Nate Robinson for good sections of the second quarter and not have to run him down, considering how low they were on guard. So I would say this game was decided in the first half, and specifically the second quarter. The Nets just didn't match Chicago's intensity to start the game, and that ended up costing them.
I honestly felt that the Nets just didn't want this game as badly as the Bulls. Evan Roberts from WFAN here in New York, we were listening to the pregame show with him, and he basically made a very interesting comment. He felt you see the emotion from the Bulls. You feel that you see the want. You see that the desperation. You saw that in game six. You saw that in the triple overtime game. You didn't see that from the Nets. I've criticized this team since day one. I've attacked the decision-making. If you remember when this season started, what they had on their roster before Deron Williams resigned, they had Gerald Wallace who resigned with them, Brook Lopez who resigned with them, Deron Williams who resigned for them. They traded Joe Johnson. They resigned Chris Humphries. My biggest complaint about this team is it was put together with bad contracts. Reggie Evans is a backup center. If he's your starting power forward, you're in trouble. And, you know,
yeah.
2 points, 13 boards, didn't attempt a field goal last night.
You know, the thing I've noticed is there's a reluctancy for the Nets to change their rotation, whether it's Marshawn Brooks. I understand he's not a good defensive player, or whether it's more C.J. Watson. I really thought, and they mentioned it on TV, the Nets' refusal to go to more perimeter players, whether it's Gerald Wallace at the four and C.J. Watson at the two and Joe Johnson at the three, those types of lineups, you see what happens with the Knicks. When you create mismatches, it forces Chicago to have to change their defense. They're not able to play basically 4-on-5 and have a roaming double like they do when Reggie Evans is on the court, or even when Gerald Wallace is struggling. The Nets really continue to just bash their head against the wall in regards to attacking Chicago's defense. I agree. Reggie Evans starting is a really bad idea. I think the Nets really need to find a way with the limited resources that they have going into this offseason. You know, they have a first-round pick. They do have Chris Humphries' expiring contract if some team is silly enough to trade for it. But they need to find a way to get more athletic on the wing, maybe another shooter, someone that can allow them to go with these small-ball lineups that are the rave in the NBA, and the good teams have the ability to do that. Miami does it. The Knicks do it. San Antonio can do it. Oklahoma City can do it. The good teams create mismatches on the offensive end of the court, because as good as you are as good as a team can be defensively, if you can't score, you can't win. So the Nets need to find a way to get those types of players, maybe one or two, that can allow them to, instead of going with these big lineups that are archaic in the NBA, you need to find a way to get smaller, get it quicker, get more athletic. That's the thing they need to figure out how to do this offseason.
Now, I saw some tweets last night about Joe Johnson. Listen, 2-for-14, 1-for-9 for three-point line. They started calling it John Stark-esque. You can't go that route. We're not even close to that type of level. Here's a simple fact of the matter, too, and there's little things that I've noticed. The game started off with Deron Williams being guarded by Nate Robinson. Deron Williams should have been posting up Nate Robinson the whole entire time.
Absolutely.
Then they made the switch, and they put Jimmy Butler on Deron Williams. When they made that switch, Deron struggled. Deron Williams struggled as soon as they made that switch.
And you know what? You're right, absolutely. They did a good job of putting Jimmy Butler on him because they realized that Joe Johnson wasn't going to be able to beat them off the dribble. All they needed to do was contest his jump shot. Joe Johnson was not going to be able to pump fake physically, the way he was battling the plantar fasciitis, was not going to be able to get to the basket or on a drive or anything. So they could really not worry too much about if we double Joe Johnson, it's going to ruin our rotations, or we double off of Joe Johnson, it's going to ruin our rotations because someone's got to get back on him. They were able to put a better, a longer, faster, younger, stronger player like Jimmy Butler on Deron Williams, which is kind of what Miami, if you go back in time, remember what Miami did to Derrick Rose after game one of the Eastern Conference Finals a couple years ago? They put LeBron on him, and it completely nullified everything Derrick Rose needed to do for the Bulls to be effective offensively. That's pretty much what Chicago did, to a lesser extent. Obviously, Jimmy Butler's not LeBron James, but that's the idea they did. They put a bigger guy on a guard that really wants to be able to see passing lanes and get to the basket and find driving lanes. And Butler really made those impossible or tougher for Deron Williams to see. And you saw it. The Nets went through these long stretches where their offense just bogged down and they were on the perimeter and they got shallow penetration and kicked it out for a contested three. So that was a really good change by Thibodeau there to put Butler on there and allow Nate Robinson to kind of freelance off of Joe Johnson a bit, or even he was guarding Gerald Wallace sometimes.
One of the big things that I made a very interesting point of is Deron Williams struggled against Kirk Heinrich. When Kirk Heinrich was guarding Deron Williams, Nate Robinson was able to come off the bench and get a better feel of the game and be able to dictate the offense. What I love about Nate Robinson in the Bulls' offense is he has a similar style that Derrick Rose has, or the 1-4 offense, where he's able to create with him as the focal point. When he starts a game, you lose that punch off the bench. You're going to have Heinrich and Deng back for the next series. And you might even get Derrick Rose in for a game three. So there's a lot of good here for the Bulls. And I don't think that a lot of people are going to say the Nets lost that game instead of the Bulls winning. But the Bulls went out there and they took that game.
I would agree. The Nets didn't come out and match the intensity, but you could tell the Bulls, starting with Joakim Noah, basically guaranteeing the game, you saw that rallied the rest of the team, and they wanted to at least give all the effort to try and prove Noah right. And that's what happens when a star player makes a guarantee. It can, you know, if it goes wrong, it looks silly, just ask Patrick Ewing, but it got
Patrick started making them every single year. By
97, everyone's like, again, really? Come on. All right, we get it. You want to win the game. We get it. Please stop talking. But when you go on the road for a game seven, it's already an us against the world mentality because you're on the road. You're against in a hostile environment. Noah doing that can almost galvanize them even more. I think sometimes in a game seven, even though the home teams have a really high number, I think it's 80% or a high 70, maybe 80% of the home teams win a game seven. Sometimes if the game gets away from you a little bit, it can turn to a detriment to be at home because the crowd gets silent, the opposing team gets the momentum. They kind of allow themselves to get out of sync. You know, the pressure mounts on a home team if the game gets tight in the second half. The road team is playing with house money because they can say, hey, we were on the road in a game seven. We're not supposed to win this game, especially with all the injuries. This is a game the Bulls very easily could have came in, all these injuries on the road, blowing a 3-1 lead and getting blown out by 15, and they'd have every excuse, and no one would say, boy, what a bad showing by the Bulls. But the fact that the Bulls rallied around everything, Joakim Noah, they rallied around their key star who's playing on one foot and giving 130%, rallied around them, and everybody came in. If they saw that type of effort from Joakim Noah, and I'm Marcus Teague, and I'm 100%, I'm going, you know, 130 miles an hour every time I'm on the court, because if he can do it, I can do it. And Noah really gave the Bulls that type of feel as this series went along. That if I'm able to do this at 100%, everybody else just has to give the maximum effort and we'll have a very good chance of winning games.
I'm not arguing that aspect of it either. I'm a really big fan of the way the Bulls came out and played, and I applaud Noah for I don't want to say put, I think emotionally he put the team on his back. I thought he did an excellent job of rallying the troops. Listen, Bellinelli, what an effort by him too, as well. He's put the team on his shoulders as well, hitting big three after big three after big three. Some of the shot selection coming out of the half was a real, question mark. Would be the right way of saying it. The shot selection that they did was, I don't know. I'm one of those people where I fully believe you have to, as it comes down to putting four full quarters together, you know that every team is going to make a run type of mentality. I guess that's the right way. You know, you put that frame of mind that every team is going to make a run, and you go with it. You roll with those punches, and I felt that Noah made some tough. He made some tough, real tough, some real tough plays. Hit some baskets that you were really, really stunned that the Bulls were able to really silence that Brooklyn crowd. First off, I've watched a lot of Brooklyn games this year. I never felt that crowd was really. I don't feel like they're loyal to that team yet.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
I really feel that at the end of the day, you have to really understand that this team, this Brooklyn Nets team, it's not meshing. They were the fourth seed in the playoffs, and they had some really nice win streaks this year due to the fact that they had a lot of games against Philly, games against the Charlotte Bobcats, the Detroit Pistons. You want to consider yourself a playoff team, you have to win those games. And they won those games. They beat the teams that they were supposed to beat. The Chicago Bulls are an oiled, I don't want to say they're an oiled machine, because that's not fair to...
well-oiled machines?
Yeah, that's not really fair to all these oiled machines out there. We're awaiting, by the way, right now, we're awaiting Steve Cozell from the Chicago Bulls. He's going to join us in a few minutes to discuss last night's game with the Brooklyn Nets. Listen, Boozer and Miller, when they were on the floor together, dominated the Nets. They were boxing out both Evans and Lopez, and it was to the point where Boozer was actually on Lopez, even though Lopez had a height advantage. I never felt at all last night that Brooklyn was really a threat to them. Once they built that big lead, it was almost like the Celtics on Friday night. You had to come back.
And how many offensive rebounds did they? How many offensive rebounds did they have in the first? I think they had 7 offensive rebounds in the first quarter, and I think Butler got 1 or 2, but a majority of them, at least 5 of them, were both Boozer and Noah just attacking the glass and taking the big men of the Nets out of position to grab those rebounds.
Yeah, it was definitely Noah was I don't want to say Noah was the showstopper. You know, for us wrestling fans, we know what the showstopper is all about. I think that we're now at a point where, the Bulls are gonna, and now you start looking forward. Now looking past Brooklyn and look at the next round against Miami. I don't like the fact that the Bulls are going to be able to really push the Heat around a little bit. Heat just don't have enough girth to battle with the Bulls. You know, that's the one thing everybody goes, the Heat live on transition baskets.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the Miami Heat live on. And
the Bulls don't really turn the ball over too much.
No.
The Bulls make what people like to call dead ball turnovers. Balls that they dribble off their foot and it goes out of bounds. Balls that they throw to somebody and it bounces off their hands and goes out of bounds. Moving screens count as turnovers. They're dead ball turnovers. Very rarely do the Bulls, and I think you notice in this series with the Nets, they didn't allow the Nets a lot of transition points. The Nets didn't get out in transition a lot based off the turnovers. There were a little bit at the end of game 5, and obviously C.J. Watson had one at the end of game 4, but they don't really beat themselves with a lot of really bad turnovers. You know, those the cross-court passes that LeBron cuts off and sprints in for a dunk. They don't make a lot of those. Those are what the Heat live on. You're 100% right. The Heat live on those. That's where they get those extra 10 or so points, because they're not a really great offensive team. They're very efficient because LeBron James is shooting 65%. But if you can hold the Heat to under, you know, 15 fast break points, you're in very good position. And the Bulls play good enough defense, and they're smart enough offensively where I think they can do that. Are they going to win? I don't think so. I think there's a little too much offensive firepower in Miami. But someone mentioned it on Twitter last night. I think it was Chris Mannix, actually, in between boxing, who said the Heat are going to feel the Bulls a lot more than the Knicks are going to probably feel the Pacers, if that makes any sense. The physicality of Chicago is a lot more than the physicality of Indiana even is, and Indiana's a pretty physical team. But I think the way the Bulls play, the style they play, even if the Heat win, they're going to feel that effect of playing the Bulls for five or six games, I think, more than the Knicks are going to feel playing the Pacers for five or six games.
Yeah, I agree. And not only that, but as far as Chicago and Miami is concerned, the one thing we haven't even brought up yet is the fact that Derrick Rose might be in the lineup for this series at some point or another.
You really think
Derrick
so?
Rose, yeah, I think so. I think that he's starting to get that itch. I think a lot of people had picked them to.
Stoudemire. It's not like Stoudemire, though, who's probably going to come back Sunday or next Saturday for Game 3 if he goes through those practices on Thursday and Friday well, like they're expecting him to. Derrick Rose hasn't played all year, though. It's very tough, especially against a team like Miami. He would have had a better opportunity coming back against a team like the Nets than coming against Miami in the second round of the playoffs. That's a very tough situation to not only put Derrick Rose in as himself, but the team as well. You know, they did mention it on TNT. I don't think Derrick Rose would mess up the continuity as much, because Nate Robinson and Bellinelli, their guards are very ball heavy. They don't they run a lot of guard plays that then break into dump downs and stuff for Noah and Boozer and Dang when he's healthy. So I don't know if Derrick Rose coming back messes up their rhythm offensively. But I just don't know if, even if he plays 10, 15 minutes a game, you know, acclimating himself back to that. If you're the Bulls in the playoffs and he needs three or four games to get himself into basketball shape, banging against other players that aren't on his team and not practice situations, can you afford that in the second round of the playoffs, though?
Yeah, but here's the thing, though. You have to remember two very important things. One, he was cleared in February to start playing, ready to play games. He's been practicing with the Bulls every day. He's been out there for a shoot around every single day. I think this is what the Bulls were hoping for. I think this is what the Bulls wanted. I think the Bulls wanted to be in the second round with the Heat. I think this is what they were hoping for. This is what they wanted. I can't say it any other way than I think they wanted the opportunity to play the Heat and have Derrick Rose come back. I think Derrick Rose has been training for this moment from day one. And coming back and helping the Bulls possibly beat the Heat in the second round of the playoffs, wouldn't that send something a bigger splash across the world? I think what I think this does do is I think this minimizes the NBA season. That's what I do think it does. Because Derrick Rose was cleared to play since February, and he hasn't stepped on the floor. If he comes back in the playoffs and the Bulls somehow win a championship, that really minimizes the NBA season.
I'll tell you this. The one thing I'll say about that, everyone talks about they're missing Derrick Rose. Their offensive efficiency, their offensive point totals, I mean, they couldn't score with Derrick Rose. Remember, everyone said, God, they got to get another shooter to go with Derrick Rose. Derrick Rose needs some offensive help. Well, I'll tell you right now, they didn't do it. So if everyone's coming back and expecting Derrick Rose to be this above all thing, it's not going to happen because they couldn't score anyway with him, just like they struggled to score without him. You know, and I'm not sure his defense is going to be there where it normally is for Derrick Rose, that it can be enough. I think if Derrick Rose comes back, it definitely throws a monkey wrench into the Heat's plans. I think it changes their defensive scheme. I think it changes how they attack the Bulls. But again, even if the Bulls get past the Heat, then they're playing either Indiana or New York. Two teams, again, that Indiana can't score, the Knicks can score, and they struggle with some defense sometimes, especially with guards. So I just don't know.
Online with us right now, our good friend from the Chicago Bulls, Steve Canizzo. Steve, how are you, my friend?
Hello?
Hi, Steve.
Yes.
Steve, how are you? Randy Zillia, Mike Travis, host of Real Sports Talk Radio, backsportspage.com. How are you today?
How are you guys? I'm doing well.
Thanks for taking a few minutes with us on this Sunday. So they made it fun for you last night, didn't they?
I couldn't hear that. Go again.
I said the Chicago certainly made it fun for you guys last night, didn't they?
That was incredible. It really was. I don't think Bulls fans were expecting a victory, especially without Luol Deng and Kirk Heinrich. And, of course, we know Derrick Rose wasn't going to play, but I was stunned. I really was, the way they held out and captured that Game 7 on the road.
Hey, Steve, I mentioned this earlier. I thought really, and a lot of people mentioned it after the game, the Nets didn't match the intensity Chicago came out with. I thought really the Bulls, whether it was on the offensive glass or just in terms of the effort everybody came out with 1 through 9 in that first half, I thought the game was really decided in those first 24 minutes there, and they kind of made enough plays in the second half to hold off the Nets. Is that kind of how you saw that game unfold?
Yeah, you know what? I mean, the Bulls, a couple of these games, I think they scored 75, 76 points the whole game. They're a low-scoring team. Sometimes they find trouble scoring the ball, especially without Luol Deng on the floor. And to score 60 points in the first half was amazing. And when you're down 17, we've seen it, you know, every year in the NBA, when you're down that much, it takes an awful lot to get back. I mean, obviously the Nets made a nice run in the third quarter, and they cut it to 5 three times in the fourth, then got it down to 4 with a couple minutes to go. But you expend so much energy that, you know, to come back from a 17-point deficit, and as good as the Bulls are and as disciplined, it was asking a lot of the Nets, and I wasn't surprised the Bulls held them off. But, you know, you're still playing on the road, limited roster, and depleted bench and the whole thing. So I still was a little shocked that they held out at the end.
You know, Steve, one of the big highlighting parts of this series has been the injury situation with Chicago, with Luol Deng out, Kirk Heinrich sitting out, and Nate Robinson taking the lead guard role. Beginning of the series, it looked like Darren was struggling against Kirk, and what made this series really interesting to me was Nate was able to give an offensive spark off the bench, and it was obvious in Game 6 that the Bulls needed a little spark off the bench, and they really just didn't get it. Even though they made the comeback and they were close right at the end of Game 6, they were able to close the deal out in Game 7. What does Kirk Heinrich bring to this team since Derrick Rose is out? At this point, now we're in Round 2 against Miami, which they don't have a dominant point guard. So how important is the point guard position going to be against the Bulls?
Well, the key is, Heinrich is so good. He's just he's a pro's pro, and he's been playing this game so long. You know, I learned a lot from John Paxson doing radio with him for 5 years on the Bulls radio network about guys who know how to play the game. Heinrich obviously may not have the most talent in the world. You know, he wasn't a big Bulls hit here with fans early this season. They said, why are we bringing Heinrich back and paying him? You know, he's washed up, blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden, he becomes one of the most valuable guys on the team because he plays defense and he organizes these guys. He gets Carlos Boozer his shots. He gets Deng his shots. He gets Noah his shots in the paint. When Nate Robinson is in there, it's a little bit erratic. Nate is really looking for his shot, so he doesn't run the offense like Heinrich does. Obviously, he doesn't play the defense like Heinrich does. And then, of course, when you have to start Nate Robinson, you don't have Kirk Heinrich. The problem is you lose that off the bench. Nate is great off the bench with that scoring punch. So when we don't have Heinrich and you have to start Nate, all of a sudden you're looking at Marcus T or Daquan Cook. And fortunately, those guys played really well in the first half for the Bulls. I think that was one of the keys to last night's victory was the play of the rookie Marcus T from Kentucky and the Daquan Cook, the former Heat player. Daquan Cook had 3 assists in the first half. He had 9 assists all season in the regular season for the Bulls. So when you get production like that, it's amazing. But back to your original first question there, it was, Heinrich is just, he organized the team so well, and he frustrates the other team's point guards. We've seen it all year, but he did a great job on Deron Williams, and I'm again, amazed that we did it without Kirk Heinrich yesterday.
Steve, talk a little bit about Marco Bellinelli. I think when Deng went down before Game 6, that was kind of where everybody decided, oh, there's no way the Bulls can do this, especially if these guys can't go for a possible Game 7. Bellinelli has really stepped up in a starting role. He's averaging over 23 points a game, I believe, in Game 6 and 7. Made huge shots last night. Talk about the drive to the basket in the fourth quarter against the shot clock. He hit a huge 3, I think, to put him up 9 or 10 late in the fourth quarter. This is a guy, I think, maybe in the going forward against Miami, where if they get Deng back and they get Heinrich back, all of a sudden now, if Gibson can get a little healthy, doesn't this maybe give the Bulls a little bit more offensive firepower against a team that they can really use it against? If Bellinelli, Nate, and Gibson can give them that same type of production off the bench?
And that's the key, guys, yeah. I mean, you get Deng and Heinrich back in the starting lineup, you're right. Then you have Bellinelli and Nate Robinson and Taj Gibson coming in off the bench. You don't need to start Bellinelli and Nate Robinson. And Bellinelli was so effective. You're right. I mean, the driving layup, the threes he hit, and he almost hit a huge 3 in Game 6 to win the game or tie it at least, just came up short. But he has been really good. And nothing scares him out there. I mean, he gives great effort, but he really plays without fear, which I think is a real key. He's not afraid to take the big shot. You can see that he's driving to the basket for a 3-point shooter. You know, you got Ray Allen, who you really never see. He's a great 3-point shooter, obviously, maybe the best that's ever played. Kyle Korver, the same role. The great 3-point shooters never drive to the basket, but Bellinelli will surprise you because of his ability to attack the basket and break guys down. And you can't guard him that closely when he has that move.
Give me a thought on Tom Thibodeau real quick. I thought me and Randy spoke about this earlier. His decision to switch Nate Robinson onto one of the perimeter guys, either Brooks or Joe Johnson when they were in, and put Jimmy Butler on Deron Williams, I said was kind of reminiscent of when Miami put LeBron James on Derrick Rose a couple years ago in the Eastern Conference Finals after Rose torched them in Game 1. They put LeBron on him later in the series, and it completely flummoxed the Bulls. And I think that's something that Butler did to Deron Williams. It got the Nets out of a rhythm and really bogged them down, and the Bulls were able to take advantage of it. His coaching job, I think, this year has been off the charts, and I think you would agree with me, but talk about specifically some of the adjustments he made defensively against the Nets as the series went along and some moves he's got to make against Miami.
Well, Thibodeau's amazing. I mean, we love him here in Chicago. I always say he's worth between 5 and 10 wins. I mean, his stuff is so good. And, he played Jimmy Butler. Jimmy Butler played all of 7 minutes in the playoffs last year. 7 minutes. That's all he played in that first series against Philadelphia. And the last 2 games, he played every minute on the floor, all 48 minutes in Games 6 and 7. Jimmy Butler, the kid from Marquette, who hardly saw the floor last year, all of a sudden a starter and a really, really sharp player for the Bulls. I mean, it's been amazing. But Thibodeau is so good defensively. His adjustments and doing a job with putting Jimmy Butler and showing Deron Williams different looks and then showing Joe Johnson different looks. I mean, look at Joe Johnson last night, 2 of 14. What did he miss? 8 of his 9 3-pointers that he attempted? I know he was suffering from a foot injury, but it was pretty amazing stuff. But Thibodeau, again, NBA Coach of the Year his first year. I think should have won in his second year because the Bulls had the best regular season records. And then this year, playing with all the injuries and without Derrick Rose and still finishes as the fifth seed, he is really, really good. I mean, I still think he's one of the best, if not the best coaches in the NBA. And you're looking at Greg Popovich and a couple of really good ones, obviously. George Karl had a great year. But they'll do, you know what, what I like what they do against Miami guys is that what they've done when they've been effective, the Bulls, and he played four times during the regular season, and they the Bulls and Heat each won two games. And what I liked is that they took LeBron James and made him a scorer. You know, LeBron's best when he is averaging near a triple-double. That's when he's most effective in his games. Well, they let LeBron score. Let him get his 30, 35 points, but don't let him get the assists, and don't let him get the rebounds and everything. Plus, I love the job they do on Chris Bosh, pushing him away from the basket, even though he's not a good rebounder. And then with Dwayne Wade, we usually frustrate Dwayne Wade as well. The Heat don't like to play us. I'm not saying the Bulls are going to win the series. I think we'll give them a series. The Heat have won 41 of their last 43 games. They're on an incredible roll. They've had seven full days off. But believe me, Tom Thibodeau will throw wrinkles in there. He'll frustrate the Miami Heat.
My last question for you is, of course, the million-dollar question of whether we're going to see Derrick Rose on the floor. And do you think having Nate Robinson on the floor with this team is almost similar to the way Derrick Rose likes to play, where it's almost the style of the 1-4 type of offense? Let Derrick create and find the guys in their spots. It feels like when Nate's on the floor, it has a similar feel to it. Do you ever get that type of feeling?
Yeah, a little bit. I there's really two different players. I mean, Nate is really looking for a shot, and he doesn't drive to the basket that much. You know, he likes to almost like Ben Gordon when we had him with the Bulls. He likes to create his own shot. Rose is a totally different player. I mean, Derrick is so explosive going to the basket. He's become, I think, a much better shooter, even though he hasn't played this year. I'm watching him when he usually does his hour and a half warm-up before the game. And he's taken the hitch out of his shot. He's become a better three-point shooter. I think we're going to see that with Derrick Rose. Two totally different players, in my opinion. And, you know, but Derrick, again, he talked yesterday before the shoot-arounds in Brooklyn. And, again, they said, God, you know, Derrick, just tell us you're not going to play the rest of the year. And he's still leaving it open. So I don't think he's going to play in this series, but he could surprise us. His brother, Reggie Rose, who serves as his manager, said, you know, Derrick is 90% mentally there. So I'm still holding out a little hope that Derrick might surprise us and come back, even though if I was to bet on it, I would say he probably wouldn't come back.
The great Steve Cozzo, who does radio with the Chicago Bulls, thank you very much for giving us a few minutes today. And, you know, we'll talk to you later through the playoffs.
Anytime, guys. I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you.
Take care.
And I believe Mike Tramatazzi is back with us here.
Hello.
And let's welcome in our good friend down in Miami, Sid Rosenberg. Sid, how are you, my friend?
Hey, guys. I'm pretty good. How's the I'm on my landline outside by my pool on a 82-degree sunny day here in Miami, getting ready for Knicks Pacers today and Heat Bulls tomorrow. How does the audio sound?
Very good, actually.
It's very good, but it's only going to be better if you have a nice frosty beverage while you're at the pool.
You know what, guys? My nice frosty beverage days are over. I was the king of the nice frosty beverage, but two rehabs and countless columns in the New York Post, the Daily News, the New York Times, and that type of thing got me to the point where my nice frosty beverage is over. If you mean like a banana smoothie or a Diet Coke, I got plenty of those.
Okay, that works. That works. And Sid, we just had a member of the Bulls broadcasting team on with us, and I have to get your opinion. I texted you this earlier. I felt that Brooklyn never was really in that game last night, even in the beginning of the first half. I really felt you saw the body language that the Bulls wanted that game more. You're an uncut type guy. I got to get your opinion on this.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I mean, I don't know. You know, wanting it, I think, is always a difficult thing because when you talk about want it, then you're talking about effort, right? I mean, then you're saying, hey, the Nets, they didn't really want it, and the Bulls came out and played harder. And, you know, I used to say that quite a bit. This team wanted it more. And I'm not saying that every now and then, guys, you don't come across a game where one team doesn't want it more. You know, when you have these, like, college football bowl games and you got a school who's got a long, you know, tradition and they're playing in, the Nut Bowl on a Tuesday night, they don't want it as much as, let's say, you know, a team like Detroit. But I think when you get to a seventh and deciding game of an NBA playoff series, I think both teams want it. I just think there's a lot of things that go into play. One team may be better. One team may be more nervous. I mean, I don't know exactly what it is, but the Bulls came out yesterday. They took it away from Brooklyn right away. I mean, look, this is not a Brooklyn team that's loaded with Game 7 experience. I know Darren Williams had some playoff games out in Utah, Joe Johnson in Atlanta, but the fact is this is a very seasoned veteran Chicago basketball team, even with their injuries all season long. And I disagree with the guy from the Bulls, although he did say you probably won't see Derrick Rose. You definitely won't see Derrick Rose. First of all, they're not beating Miami. Even if they do, he ain't coming back. Because if they can beat two teams, Brooklyn and Miami, without him, why would they bring him back at that point anyway? So, but the point is, guys, I don't know if they wanted it more, but Chicago took it to them early, and Brooklyn was like a team that was not going to be able to come back.
Sid, I don't know if we're, you know, nitpicking here, but obviously the talk around the Heat is that Dwayne Wade's knee is not 100%. He's even mentioned that it's something he's probably going to have to monitor throughout the playoffs again, just like last year. With the level LeBron James is playing at, I mean, it's not like last year where everyone questioned, hey, if Wade can't play, you know, I have questions about the Heat. How good LeBron James and that level he put himself at this year, does that kind of eliminate that thought everyone had last year when Wade got hurt? Or does Wade not being 100% give teams that can guard multiple positions, like maybe New York or Indiana or even Chicago if they get lucky, a chance? Or is it just LeBron's too good this year? How is that different from last year, if it is?
It's not. Wade is still a huge, huge part of this basketball team. We know LeBron has taken his game to a different level. I saw Michael Jordan play just about every game of his career, guys. I didn't see Oscar Robertson or Kareem or those guys play every single game, but I saw enough of it. Michael Jordan is still the greatest basketball player I've ever seen. I won't even argue the topic, but I never saw Michael or anybody else have the type of season I saw from LeBron James this year. And listen, I'm a Knicks fan. I can't stand the Heat, but so it pains me to say that, but the point is, from an efficiency basis, guys, shooting percentage, finding teammates, playing defense, from an efficiency percentage, Michael Jordan along the way had some horrendous shooting nights. You never see that anymore from LeBron. Game in and game out, this guy shoots between 50 and 60% from the floor. Doesn't matter. You're not going to win a championship with just LeBron James. As they move on, and certainly Milwaukee was not much of a competition, as they move on, you're going to notice that LeBron cannot do it all by himself. Yeah, guys, he can go out and score 35 points tonight. That ain't going to get it done. So the idea that now Dwayne Wade becomes less important because LeBron James has really risen, his game has gone to a level like maybe we've never seen, is, I think, way overrated. Dwayne Wade is still the second-best basketball player on this team. He's still one of the all-time greats. He still plays certain nights at all-star caliber, and they need Dwayne Wade to be really good in this round to very good to almost great in the Eastern Conference Finals and the NBA Championship if they're going to win. Now, look, he has not been 100% healthy for years. He's in his 30s, guys. He's been playing for a long time. He's won two championships and a gold medal, and he plays with reckless abandon. He takes the basketball to the basket. He takes a lot of contact, Dwayne Wade. We know that. Back in 2006 when the Heat won their first championship and beat Dallas, that was Dwayne Wade getting to the free throw line just about every possession. That's the type of game that he plays. But the idea that Dwayne Wade is not as important, nonsense. He's a bit nicked up. He has not been healthy all year, but he needs to be very good to great the rest of the way or the Heat don't win.
Sid, I want to go against that a little bit too. I think Wade could be less than 100%, but because this year the Heat has a better supporting cast than last year. I do like Rashard Lewis for them. Ray Allen's able to contribute off the bench. It just seems like they have a little bit more firepower.
No, there's no question they do. Ray Allen has been a tremendous pickup. The guy, you know, burying threes and giving them instant offense off the bench. Chris Anderson, the Birdman, has been a huge pickup.
He's been amazing.
Much like Warren Joy and Kenyon Martin at Madison Square Garden. The two of those guys, to me, are the biggest midseason pickups I've seen in years. Anderson to Miami and Kenyon Martin to the Knicks. They are a much better basketball team. They're deeper and more balanced. But don't kid yourself, guys. This time of year, it's about the superstars. You know, does John Paxson make a wide-open shot for Michael Jordan? Yeah. Does Steve Kerr make a wide-open shot for Michael Jordan? Yeah. But when the Bulls won their championships, it was still Michael and Scottie. So you can talk about Rashard Lewis. You could talk about Miller. You could talk about Allen. You could talk about a countless number of Miami Heat players, that Shane Battier, that can contribute along the way. But this league is about the stars. If the Heat are going to win another championship, it's about really the big three, including Chris Bosh, but mainly LeBron and Dwayne Wade. They are better, you're right. They are deeper, you're right. But they're not going to win a championship unless their superstars play at that level.
Do you think, Sid, that people are kind of underestimating the other three teams in the Eastern Conference? I know people really aren't underestimating the Knicks because they expect the Knicks to maybe get past Indiana or Indiana get past the Knicks and struggle with the Heat, but everybody seems to just be cementing the Heat into the NBA Finals. The Heat have the best player in the league, four-time MVP. They won it last year, 66 wins. But I think if you look at the other three teams, you're right. The supporting cast for the Heat are going to be big because they can kill you if you overplay LeBron James and you leave Battier open. He's been lethal from the corner. But the Knicks, Indiana, and Chicago, while they may not have the ability of like a LeBron James, they still have really good all-star players at certain positions, but they have those secondary guys. Their defenses, I think, can take away the other players from Miami and kind of almost funnel it to a LeBron or a Chris Bosh where they've got to score. Those three have to combine for 85 points for them to have a chance. Do you see that in the East? Or is that misreading?
No, I don't. I wish I did because I'm a diehard Knicks fan, and believe me, I just want the chance. You know, I want to beat Indiana because Miami's going to beat Chicago and give me a chance. And I got to deal with Miami Heat fans every single day. And collectively as a group, guys, I worked in New York at WFAN. I had to deal with a lot of really obnoxious fans. I was a Met fan growing up in Yankee Town. I've never seen a bigger collective group of arrogant, self-entitled, obnoxious fans like the Heat fans. But you know what? They deserve to be that way. The Heat are much better than anybody else in these playoffs. It's not close. They're much better. And look, by the way, they don't have to score 80 a night, LeBron, Dwayne, and Chris Bosh, because they are magnificent defensively. So, you know what? If they score 60, where are the Knicks going to get 60 from? Is Carmelo going to give you 30? Then what? The Heat, I mean, we talk about the Heat offensively with LeBron, Dwayne, Bosh, Ray Allen. They are a magnificent defensive basketball team. They really are, guys, a lot better than anybody left in these playoffs. Now, look, that doesn't mean Chicago can't beat them. That doesn't mean the Knicks can't beat them or Indiana. That doesn't mean San Antonio, Memphis, or Oklahoma City can't beat them. We've seen good teams, better teams lose, you know. Maybe somebody nicks their ankle. Maybe Dwayne's knee gets worse. Maybe LeBron has a bad series. But no one is overestimating Miami and underestimating everybody else. They're exactly right. There is no logical reason to believe Miami loses a series, let alone maybe two games in any of these. And again, it pains me to say that. I'm a Knicks fan living in Miami. I can't stand the Heat and or their fans, although I do like riding the organization. But really, if you look at this from a logical basketball standpoint, yeah, they're exactly right. The Heat are a lot better than everybody else. And barring any real miracle, they should win the championship.
Sid, you're a diehard Knicks fan. I got to bring this up to you. I'm looking at the salary structure for where they are for next year. There is a very good possibility that J.R. Smith will not be on this team next year, unless, you know, barring you're able to move Stoudemire. Do you try and make some moves to try and keep J.R. Smith, or do you just go out there and try and find a suitable replacement for him?
It's a good question. It depends upon the money, right? I mean, J.R. Smith had a wonderful season. He won the Sixth Man of the Year award, and he became a better basketball player, to J.R. Smith's credit. Now, we know, of course, that the last series, he didn't exactly afford himself well. He had a brutal, and I mean brutal, shooting game in Game 5, in Game 6, I should say. We also know that he was suspended one game in this series for really making a bonehead play. I mean, that's just stupid. There's no other way to put it. So I don't think J.R. Smith endeared himself in the fans of the Knicks this last series, but let's not confuse the issue. He had a wonderful regular season. He's become a much better all-around basketball player under Mike Woodson. He is certainly, at this point, their second-best player. You know, Stoudemire, to me, is a guy that I hope I don't see again. You know, you guys talk about guys coming in and Derrick Rose in Chicago. Every time I read about Amari Stoudemire ready to return, I get sick to my stomach. It's the last thing I want to see. I mean, they're already a team that struggles at times defensively. Outside of a couple of fourth quarters, a against the Boston last series. We know the Knicks, after December, really struggled defensively. And while Stoudemire can come off the bench and hit 6 out of 7, you talk about a liability on defense. He's the all-time worst. So, but getting back to your point, it all depends on the money, what J.R. Smith wants. Listen, he's a better player, but he's still one of those guys that he can go not on games, not on a couple of games. He can go weeks where he can really, really hurt you, taking some ill-advised shots and not shooting well. I'm not completely sold at this point that J.R. Smith is ready to be talked about at that next level, although, again, I give him all the credit in the world for improving this year. So, listen, if he's willing to take a modest offer, he keeps saying he wants to stay in New York, he wants to retire a Knick. If he's willing to take a modest offer, I do it. If this guy wants big, big money, I say goodbye.
And do you think that Kenyon Martin has earned himself another contract to stay with the Knicks?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. There's no doubt. I mean, don't forget, guys, his first 10-day contract, he never suited up once. I mean, the Knicks kept bringing back Kenyon 10-day contracts. And I don't even know if they, when they first signed them, guys, if they really intended on using them, to be honest. And if they did, I don't think they could have ever imagined he would have been as solid as he's been, which sounds kind of crazy because, let's face it, last year in Los Angeles for the Clippers, he made contributions, and he's not that far away from making good contributions in Denver with the Nuggets. So I think he has provided this Knickerbocker team with a level of toughness. He rebounds, he blocks shots, he does all of the dirty work that we got used to seeing guys like Charles Oakley and Anthony Mason and those guys do for years, which the Knicks need. They need those guys, especially on a basketball team where most of the guys just like to shoot. So I would say, yes, I would say that, and again, I'm not in the Knicks front office, so I can't give you an absolute, but if I'm in the Knicks front office, I make sure Kenyon Martin is back next year. But look, unless somebody else saw what he did with the Knicks and says, hey, Kenyon Martin still has plenty of basketball left, look what he did for the Knicks, and somebody's going to give him big money. It all comes back to, if you can afford him, you bring him back.
Yeah, all it takes is one crazy team like the Bobcats to throw like a $7 million deal at him.
Right,
but,
then you say goodbye, and that's the end of that. But assuming everything is equal, he wants to come back, and the Knicks can pay him, and the contract is not crazy at this stage of his career, then I would hope that Kenyon Martin returns next year as a Knick.
Yeah, Sid, looking at the way the Knicks played that series against Boston, and I guess they couldn't have made it worse on my heart than if they were playing a Game 7 today. the way a guy like Iman Shumpert, as the series went on, got better and better and better, to where in Game 6, you could argue that he was probably the second best player outside of Raymond Felton for the whole series, given the way Carmelo shot and the way JR shot. His improvement going forward, and the way he's already improved, he's become a really good outside shooter, and I think you're starting to see him trust his legs more on the defensive end. Is he the X factor going forward for this team, or is it still, you know, as far as Carmelo and JR take them?
No, listen, it's Carmelo. It's as far as Carmelo takes you, and JR, you're right. I mean, that's it. You know, Carmelo has a couple of bad shooting games, and Iman Shumpert could do a terrific job defensively on anybody, and they're still going to lose. I mean, Shumpert is still not a guy that's going to give you 15 a night. You're right, he buried some big shots this last series. He is more confident with his legs to take the ball to the basket, hit some outside shots. He is getting better. Look, guys, you know that the Knickerbockers received a bunch of trade offers midway through the season. In every one of those trade requests, Shumpert's name was in there, and they weren't willing to do it. And to a man, I think a lot of guys with the Knicks were a little nervous that Shumpert was not going to be the same player with the same explosiveness he was when they drafted him out of Georgia Tech after not one but two knee injuries the last couple of years. But to Shumpert's credit, he has come back. He is a lockdown on-ball defender. I think he's already distinguished himself as one of the best on-ball defenders in the league. And look, if the Knicks go on and beat Indiana, then you know what? He's going to be the guy that may have to stop Dwayne Wade. And I think he can do it. So I think he has become a very integral part of the team's success, getting better offensively. He's always been good defensively. But again, it's about the superstars, guys. You know, the role players, the guys that are getting better, they're going to be important. But if Carmelo Anthony specifically and J.R. Smith to a certain extent, because the Knicks can still win if J.R. doesn't play great, but Carmelo does. If those guys don't have big efforts, then the Knicks are not going to win.
You know, Sid, around the rest of the league now, you know, for the rest of this playoffs, you know, you have interesting situations happening, especially with OKC without Westbrook, Memphis sort of excelling now, the Spurs, you know, and the Golden State Warriors. If you would have told us that you might have the possibility of having the Warriors and the Grizzlies in the conference finals at the beginning of the series, if I would have said that to you, would you believe me?
No, and by the way, that's where I think we're going with this, and you're right, it sounds crazy. One of those is a testament to the job that Mark Jackson has done. You know, how many years as a fan of the Knicks when we had, you know, Larry Brown and Isaiah Thomas, and I kept saying, man, we got Mark Jackson right there, and he was dying, guys, dying to get the opportunity. He loved working with Mike Breen and Jeff Van Gundy, but he was dying to get the opportunity, and already year two in Golden State, he's a guy that certainly will be considered for Coach of the Year. He may not win it, but if you include the playoffs, if you include the playoffs, which they don't, there's not a coach who's done a better job in this league. He loses David Lee that first game after getting blown out by Denver. People think Denver is a lot better to begin with, and then you lose David Lee, and then you come back and win the series. It's really a testament to him and the play of his young guard, Stephen Curry. Curry is an amazing, amazing basketball player. And also, by the way, George Karl, you know, for all the guys that jump all over Carmelo Anthony for not having a lot of playoff success in Denver, I mean, one year he did lead the Nuggets with Chauncey Billups and Kenyon Martin and J.R. Smith to the Western Conference Finals, albeit lost to the Lakers. Really, if you look back at George Karl's career, outside of that one year with Denver and one year where he had Peyton and Kemp take Seattle to the finals against Michael Jordan, George Karl is horrendous in the playoffs. I mean, first-round exits almost every single year. But you're right, Golden State's been a great story, and I like Memphis. I think Memphis wins this series. I don't think you can win without your second-best player. I keep talking about this, guys, during this conversation. You win this time of year with your superstars, and I know Kevin Durant is magnificent, second or third-best player in our game today, and they got a pretty good basketball team at that, but I don't see how you can win moving forward. Memphis is a very, very gritty. They're annoying, quite frankly. I mean, they're a very annoying basketball team, and they come at you. They've got enough offensively. They're tremendous defensively. Lionel Hollins is another guy that should be considered, if not win Coach of the Year. And I really believe without Westbrook, you're asking for too much. I agree with you. I think Memphis takes on Golden State, which is a shocker in the Western Conference Finals.
Yes, I'm so happy you said that about George Karl, because that's always been my comeback to people who say Carmelo can't win. When you have – look at the Hall of Fame caliber players he's had as a coach, and the only times he's gotten anywhere were with Ray Allen in Milwaukee. The one time he had Kemp and Peyton get to the finals, which is an atrocity considering they were like the second or third best team in the West every year, and Carmelo in Denver. You're right. I think George Karl gets this a little bit of an overrated – rap and get some of the blame not taken to him, but I want to ask you last one.
Well, listen, he's done a terrific job, yeah. Like you said, Milwaukee, Seattle, Denver, regular season, George Karl does a terrific job, and when he gets to a place, he improves things right away, but he is a first-round exit waiting to happen, and I don't know why people don't talk more about that, because he will be considered one of the great NBA coaches of all times. He's got the victories, and like you said, he's taken a bunch of different teams for the playoffs, but he has been horrendous in the playoffs, horrendous.
Yeah. Last one for me, Sid. I know he probably put it to bed during the regular season with his play, but if there's any Knicks fan that comes up to me right now and says, oh, we could still have Jeremy Lin, I might slap them or call them a name, because Raymond Felton has put that to bed. If he didn't put it to bed in the regular season, there's no talk now about how we should have had, how the Knicks could have had Jeremy Lin. I think Raymond Felton's put that to bed.
Yeah, I'm surprised. I mean, I'm not up there, but if guys are still talking about that, that surprises the hell out of me. Jeremy had an up-and-down season at best. He had his moments with Harden out there in Houston for McHale and the Rockets, but not only did you get good point guard play with Ray Felton, and for a while there, Jason Kidd was outstanding too, but I think the most important part, guys, is forgetting about the play of Felton and Kidd, it was about Carmelo. I mean, Carmelo did not like Jeremy Lin. The fact is they didn't play well together, and there was a rift, and Carmelo came to New York as the big-time superstar, and, you know, part of it is immaturity by Carmelo Anthony. I think he's matured this year, but there's no doubt that last year when Jeremy Lin was getting all the attention, that was really bothering Carmelo Anthony, and it bothered his game on the court as well. Again, that's Carmelo's issue. That was due to his immaturity, but when you get rid of Jeremy Lin, A, you bring in Felton and Kidd, and they play well, and B, you remove what became an annoyance for your best player, Carmelo Anthony. So not bringing back Jeremy Lin actually worked out well in lots of areas for the Knicks, not just the play of Felton and Kidd.
Sid, I want to thank you for taking a few minutes with us today. Really appreciate you coming on. I want you to enjoy the Knicks game today. I know you're fully behind them. I think this could be a 7-game series, and this is what they call a pick 'em.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think the Knicks win it in 7-2. I put on my Instagram this morning a picture of Spike Lee and bringing back memories of Reggie Miller at the Garden burying our Knicks and Patrick Ewing missing, you know, finger rolls down the lane. But I'm with you. I think Indiana and Vogel, they do a terrific job. They got a lot of athleticism. George has become one of the best players in the game. This is no cakewalk. This goes 7, and only because the Knicks have the home court advantage am I taking the Knicks in this series, and only because I'm dying to see Miami take on New York. But as you guys know, throughout the game on my Twitter account, @SidRosenberg, I'm very active for the Knicks and the Rangers and the Mets and the Giants and all that good stuff. So if you're watching the game later at home and you want to hop on Twitter or on Facebook and all that stuff and talk during the game, you know, I do a show Monday through Friday, 6 to 10:30, but between all of my social media accounts, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, I'm doing a show pretty much 24/7, 7 days a week. So if you guys want to hop on later on today and have some fun during the game, I'll be there. But thanks for inviting me back, guys, and you guys do a terrific, terrific job. It's always fun. Thank you, boys.
Thanks, Ted. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Always a fun guest.
I grew up listening to Sid. I grew up listening to Sid with Jody Mack in the afternoon. So that
that was fun, wasn't it?
Yeah. But he brings up a good point, though. He brought up a good point, Randy, about Dwayne Wade. I did think that there was maybe a little bit of a thought that LeBron's playing so well that they can deal with a 70%, 80% Wade. But he's right. If Wade's not playing at that 20-point or 18 to 22-point per game level where you've got to worry about him, that's a big problem for Miami. It forces the other guys to make more plays, which obviously with their resumes individually, they've shown you they can do. But it's a little bit more pressure on LeBron if he's not 100%, especially with teams that can guard a Dwayne Wade one-on-one, whether you put George Hill on him if you're Indiana, Butler if you're Chicago, Shumpert if you're New York. That's an interesting turn of events if he's not 100%.
Yeah, Sid brought up so many good points. I think that the one point that I thought was probably the most hitting was right at the beginning when we were talking about Derrick Rose, too. Derrick Rose isn't coming back, especially if you can win a series without him. Why would you think you can beat put him in after a team has sort of developed a chemistry without him against the against the best team in basketball? It's a very you're asking too much. You know what I mean? I think you're asking way, way too much. Let's go over some of our picks here. So right now you have the Indiana Pacers at the New York Knicks.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you going with this? Like my attitude is.
I saw in the Daily News today, Mitch Lawrence said Knicks in 6. Isola said Knicks in 5. Obviously Sid said Knicks in 7, strictly because of the home court, which I agree with. I think being at home again, this is an Indiana team, Randy. It's the same team as last year. It's the same team that blew a 2-1 series lead and had the lead at halftime, double-digit lead at halftime in Game 4 against the Heat at home, had the Heat completely on the ropes, standing 8 count, and they blew that game, and then they allowed the Heat to get back in it and win the series. They didn't show the mental toughness that a team needs when on the road or facing a difficult series to get through that and prevail. They didn't show it last year. They didn't really get tested that much in the Hawks series. I know they lost the 2 games in Atlanta. Maybe there was a little bit of trepidation going into Game 5 at home, but they blew them out in Game 5 at home. And they had an 18-point lead in the second half of Game 6. Yeah, they held on and allowed the Hawks to get back in it, but when push came to shove, were you expecting the Hawks to win a Game 7 in Atlanta? The Hawks hadn't won in Indiana, because the Hawks hadn't won in Indiana all season. So I didn't think they could do it, even if it went 7. The Pacers need to show me down 3-2, or down 2-1, down 3-1 in New York, say, Game 5. Can they win that game 5? Down 3-2, Game 6 at home. Can they win that Game 6? Can they win a Game 7 in New York? Can they win if they're down 2-0 in Game 3? These are the things Indiana needs to show me, because they didn't show me it last year, and they're the same exact team without Danny Granger, and they didn't need to show – they didn't get a chance to show me it in the first round against Atlanta. So I have very big questions about whether Indiana is mentally tough. With the veterans that the Knicks have, even though I think the talk of them being the oldest team in the league is a little overrated because their core is all in their young 20s like Shumpert and late 20s like Carmelo, who's 28, and Stoudemire, who just turned 30. So, but those guys have all played in it. Carmelo played in a game. He's played in the Western Conference Finals. Kidd's won a title. Chandler's won a title. Martin's played in two finals. Felton's played in the playoffs. These are guys that have more playoff experience than Indiana. I don't think they get rattled. They didn't get rattled in Game 6 in Boston when the sky was falling around them. They made enough plays to win. And I think that's the difference in this series. Boston had that mental toughness and matched it against the Knicks. I don't think Indiana has that. I think the Knicks win it in 6. I wouldn't be surprised if it went 5. It could go 7 if Indiana shows me something that they were lacking last year.
Well, here's the problem with the Indiana Pacers. They lost Darren Collison. I've always said that Darren Collison was a very, very, very
good piece. For Jan Mahimi! Who the heck trades for Jan Mahimi? And trades their starting point guard!
Well,
I wouldn't even sign Jan Mahimi to a contract. They traded for him.
Well,
traded a better player.
Well, here's the thing. Darren Collison, because they also signed DJ Augustine, and they still have George Hill.
Exactly.
Right, Paul George, has blossomed into an all-star type player. And they have Weston Hibbert. Now, you want to talk about a disappointing player this year. Last year, it was Roy Hibbert's coming out party. He seemed to be missing in action all season this past
year.
He's
digressed. I would agree. George has been better. I thought Hill's been okay.
West has been fine.
But
here's the thing.
The bench is terrible.
But here's the thing.
The bench is terrible.
I think at the end of the day, the Indiana Pacers, if they go physical and be physical and go to the basket, that's where their advantage is against the Knicks. If it turns into a jump shooting game, that's where it comes down to. Because here's the simple fact that a lot of people don't want to really talk about or even bring up when it comes to the Indiana Pacers. The Indiana Pacers don't have a guy at the end of the day when it comes down to trying to stop a 10-point run or a 12-point run. They don't have a guy who can stop that run to hit that basket.
No.
If the Pacers
no, they rely on the execution. They have to execute a pick and roll, a back screen, something like that to get someone free off a screen and roll. That the dribble drive, which they stink at, really, honestly. If you want to be honest regarding the Indiana Pacers offense, it's not good. They don't have a Paul Pierce that can create his own shot, and he didn't that series, but everybody knows Paul Pierce's resume in terms of creating a shot. Garnett can get his own shot. Jeff Green, basically the only way he could create a shot was taking the ball from one end of the court and sprinting 100 miles an hour. Zach Lowe actually mentioned this. Jeff Green's only offensive move is to sprint down court and keep going until he gets fouled or sees the rim and falls into the crowd. It's the only three things he does. How many times in that series against the Knicks did Green just sprint and he ran at somebody and either took a layup, got a dunk, got a foul, or missed it? It seemed that when Jeff Green was doing that, he was unstoppable. But when Green had to create his own shot in the half court, especially at the end of that run, Green turned the ball over and shot an air ball three, and Pierce missed the shot. The Knicks made enough plays there, and Boston, at some point you knew Boston was going to miss some shots. They had to play perfect in those final 9 minutes, and they didn't. They made just enough mistakes on the end, and their run ended. They kind of ran out of gas. So, obviously, when you're down 26, it's going to take a miracle anyway. It almost happened, but it didn't. The problem I have is Indiana. Go ahead.
I was going to say, the thing with the Celtics game the other night, the Knicks were just, they had to mentally withstand that run. It wasn't even they had to hold, it's not like hold on. You felt that they had to hold on to that lead. They had to hold on to it. You knew it was over. I said this last night to a bunch of people when we were watching the game. I felt that when Pierce missed that three, it was a 4-point game, if Pierce missed that three, that's when it was over. Because Carmelo came down and got an and-one, and that's when it was downhill for the Celts.
Exactly.
Without Jeff Green anyway that year, and without Harden and now Westbrook, they're built to contain Oklahoma City's offense than they were before because of the weapons of OKC. But Memphis is kind of the upstart team, which is weird because this is also their third straight year into the playoffs. So it's weird. It's usually you have series like the established Spurs against the upstart Golden State. This series doesn't have that. This is two well-entrenched teams. You know 100% what they're going to do. You know how they're going to play. And it's just going to see which team, as the series goes on, can counteract the adjustments the other team makes. Because this is an even series on paper. Much more even than if Westbrook was healthy or if they still had Harden.
Well, here's the other point that I'm going to make about Memphis. I love the combo of Marcus Gasol and Zach Randolph. I think those guys give every team trouble, including the Heat. That's a matchup nightmare. I think if there's a team in the Western Conference who can beat the Miami Heat, I think it is the Memphis Grizzlies. And
I agree 100%. That's actually a really good point, because everyone talks about San Antonio or Oklahoma City. Memphis is a team I don't think obviously the Heat are going to be favored against any team. But outside of the Knicks in the East, Memphis is the team that can, right now, as currently constructed, give Miami the most problems. The Knicks have matched up well with the Heat all year in terms of their perimeter guards being able to match up one-on-one with the Heat guys. You look at Memphis, they are going to be able to dominate down low. And then it comes to the point, you can't play small against them because Randolph will get LeBron in foul trouble. If you put LeBron at the four and Bosch at the five, the two of them will get those guys in foul trouble. It will really test the theory that LeBron doesn't get fouls called on him, because the way Randolph and Gasol play, you almost have to foul them.
Yeah, I sort of agree with that. And I also, what I think that's the key to that series would be Mike Conley. Again, Miami doesn't have a point guard. Miami doesn't, you know, they let LeBron bring the ball up or Wade bring the ball up. They don't have a point guard. Chalmers is not a real point guard. I feel like he's an oversized two guard for that position. Conley runs a base steady offense. Like, my only problem with Memphis still is who are you giving the ball to when the game is online? I still don't feel that's the only thing I don't feel comfortable with that. Now with the Golden State Warriors that we were talking about before, David Lee came back the other night as almost like an emotional lift for the team.
Uh-huh.
Wondering what will happen if he tries to come back away. I think he's personally done for the playoffs. I don't see him giving it a real go again for the rest of the year. I don't know how you feel about this. Wouldn't it be something, though, if he is able to really contribute and come back and sort of make a series and help? You know, I don't think
it's almost impossible. It's almost impossible. You saw how he ran. I just don't see it. I thought it was a gimmick in game six against Denver there, but it worked because it kind of rallied the fans and got him, because he came in at a time where that game was starting to maybe get away a bit from Golden State, and it kind of pumped everybody up, and they got hot in the second half. It'd be cool if David Lee did it, because it's something, you know, if you know, David Lee's out for the year, but now David Lee comes back. That's exciting. That's like, it's almost like a Willis Reed type moment. But I don't see it. I'm not sure he can physically do it. He would have to play like every other game in the series for 5 minutes, because he only played, what, 6 minutes the other night, if that. So
yeah,
I don't know.
Minutes.
What is he doing? I mean, he would have to have the most efficient 6 minutes in the history of the NBA for it to really make a dent.
I agree. I think listen, David Lee is a great player. I like his style of play. Steph Curry is the show in Golden State right now. I think and there's a lot of guys on that team who have playoff experience. You know, that's the part that a lot of people don't realize. There's a guy like Richard Jefferson. Just say what you want about Richard Jefferson. He's a decent, I think, never a max player. He was a player who was able to give you 15 to 20 points a game. But he has a lot of knowledge he can pass on. Listen, David Lee's not really playoff tested.
No.
Stephen Curry's not playoff tested. Mark Jackson, when your most experienced guy is your coach for playoffs.
Yeah, Even Bogut didn't play when the Bucks made the playoffs because he hurt his elbow, remember? Bogut didn't even play. I don't know anybody on – maybe Carl Landry?
Yeah, I think Landry had a couple good years with the Rockets in the playoffs. That was it.
And was he – I think he was with OKC a couple years ago when, or with New Orleans when they took the Lakers to six.
Yeah.
I think. I could be way off base. He might have shown up afterwards.
You're 100% right on that. So, listen, the simple fact of the matter
is... when your coach or your reserve forward or your most playoff-tested people, that's a problem. But they've stemmed it so far, and now I think that doesn't matter because now you've got around it, now everybody's got experience. They understand the momentum of the game. They understand the difference in the game from the regular season to the playoffs. So I think they're ready for that in terms of quote-unquote experience.
I think that you and I both can agree that the Western Conference is officially a crapshoot. We know who's coming out of the East. The other East series, obviously, the Miami Heat and the Chicago Bulls. Really, we haven't talked about it. Our guests have, but we haven't really talked about it that much. Listen, at the end of the day, I think the Chicago's saving grace here, and you can tell if you think I'm wrong on this, is they're just going to have to limit as much as they can the transition play. If they can keep this game a half-court game and keep the score in the 80s, low 90s, the Bulls have a fighting chance. But I think you're going to have at least two games where the Heat are going to score over 105 points a game.
I think Memphis to succeed needs to keep their games low scoring. They need to control OKC from going off and having the secondary guys like Kevin Martin drop 30. Golden State's going to want to pump that series up and get moving and get a lot of points on San Antonio. I think the Bulls want to keep the point total low, but I think Miami can play that way. That's one of those teams that can play both ways, and I think Indiana wants to keep the point low too. If the Knicks start getting into the mid-high 90s, Indiana's going to have trouble because they just cannot score at the rate the Knicks can score. The only thing they've got going for them is that they've held the Knicks to 27% three-point shooting throughout the year, and the Knicks were around 38% as a team for the season. So obviously Indiana's done a very good job in four games of holding the Knicks to a low three-point percentage. It'll be interesting to see if that's something they can continue in this series, because that'll be a big factor if they want to win, that they can't let the Knicks shoot 40% from the three-point line.
Yeah, and I think that right now the lack of big men in the Eastern Conference is catching up to its play. I don't know if that made sense or not, but I love the Grizzlies because of their height. I love the fact that San Antonio has a good mix with Duncan and Boris Diaw. I know I just said Boris Diaw. they have a good mix with Splitter. You know, the Spurs have been off for how long already? It's been close to a week.
Yeah.
They've been
golfing. Shane Battier grew a Fu Manchu.
Both the Heat and the Spurs have been done for close to a week and a half now with their first round series.
Don't be surprised if their game ones, everyone wants to talk about rest, don't be surprised if their game ones are a close game that they may win at the end or a game they actually lose. Because don't underestimate the two teams that have to play right up into that next game. The Bulls are going to be, yes, they're probably going to be tired, and the Heat may jump on them early. But the Bulls are lathered. They're in a rhythm. They know what they've been doing. They've been doing it all the way through. The Heat have been off. And that first quarter, first half is going to be a little bit of knocking the cobwebs off and getting back into their rhythm.
I'll go one further with that. I actually think that...
By the way, Randy, if you wanted to talk some hockey, the Islanders just scored about 2 minutes, not even 2 minutes into the game against Pittsburgh.
Oh, we'll talk hockey next week.
What is hockey, by the way?
Hockey's that game that people going around on skates. You know, it's funny. We were discussing this before, you know, with as far as, you know, wanting it and that the Bulls look like they wanted that game more. You know, let's not overshadow the possibility here that either the Bulls are going to have an emotional letdown for this game, or they're going to be so in key with each other, in tune with each other, because of the fact that they just played. the Nets and just won an elimination game. Again, the Heat have been off for, a couple days now, for close to a week. I have a strange feeling that game one is going to be either a blowout or it's going to be very, very close. It's going to go down to the final 2 minutes. I'm not discounting the Bulls. I've been saying that the only team that can really give the Heat trouble is the Chicago Bulls in the East. I think the Knicks will handle the. I think the Knicks will get handled by the Heat. I think it's going to be a 5-game series against the Knicks and the Heat.
I'll disagree with you. I think it's the Knicks because the Bulls play great defense, but they cannot score a lick. They struggle. They have to be perfect execution with their score with their team, kind of like Memphis in a way. The Knicks have the ability to create one-on-one. And Sam Mitchell made a great point on NBA TV the other night after Game 6. Everybody wants to talk about, ball hogging, isolation. But in the playoffs, you go to isolation because as the series progresses, teams know your sets. They scout your sets. They know your plays. So it comes down to how can you score the basket? Who is going to create their own shot? The Bulls really don't have a guy that can create his own shot outside of Derrick Rose, maybe Luol Deng, maybe Nate Robinson too. Carmelo can do it. JR can do it. Felton can do it. Shumpert can do it on occasion. Even a guy like Copeland has that skill set, even though he probably is not going to play enough to make a difference. But that's the type of thing that can, in a series, that you need. I don't think the Bulls have enough of them. I think the Knicks do. I think their way of matching up with the Heat, if you can bring a guy like Stoudemire off the bench too, is another big that can help guard against the Chris Andersons and Bosches when the Heat want to go big and small when the Heat want to go small. So I would disagree with you. I think the Bulls can give them a series, but I think the Knicks can really give them a series. If they get past – again, listen – if they don't get past the Pacers, it's all for naught. So, but if they do get by the Pacers, which I think both of us think they will, I think they can really give the Heat a problem in that Eastern Conference Finals.
Last couple questions I have for you, non-NBA related. We were just talking about hockey. Do you look at either of the two local Rangers or Islanders? Do you look at either of them going making it past the first round?
No. But I'll tell you this, if the Islanders can win one of these two games at home and go back to Pittsburgh tied 2-2 or, up 3-1 if all things break correctly, I reserve the right to change my opinion because Pittsburgh has shown you the last couple of years that they're very weak mentally in the playoffs. So the Rangers on the other end have no special teams play. Their power play stinks. Yesterday it was awful. And Washington's power play is deadly. And they showed you last night the only goal they scored was a power play goal by Mike Green. So both teams have their backs up against the wall. Obviously, right now, being tied at 1 is a lot better than being down 0-2. And right now, they have the lead with a power play. So if you're an Islanders fan right now, if you win this game and you go into game 4 up 2-1, people didn't expect you to win a game, let alone lead the series. All the pressure would be on Pittsburgh. You're just a team as an AC playing with house money at that point.
Floyd Mayweather wins again last night. Shocked by this at all?
No. I thought it was a little bit easier. He made it a little bit easier than I thought it would because Guerrero hasn't lost in years, and Mayweather hasn't fought in a year. So I thought maybe Guerrero will put up a better fight, but listen, when Mayweather's on his tactical game, there's nobody that can beat him, and that includes Manny Pacquiao. That includes even guys like Austin Trout or anybody else, Canelo. All these guys, when Mayweather's on his game at 30, even at 36, his tactical game, his defense, his counterpunching, it's just bar none. He's so far and away the most technical fighter that we've got in the sport right now.
Red Sox right now have the best record in Major League Baseball. Do you see this lasting?
Listen, their pitching's been pitching very well. Buchholz has been a guy that has pitched a lot better this year than he did last year, and he's kind of fulfilling that promise that everybody had for him as a top-of-the-rotation guy. Lester's bounced back after last year. I question their lineup, just like I question the Yankee lineup. At some point, they're going to have to get more runs because, pitching's going to be off. You look at the other night, Sabathia lost 2-0 to Oakland because they couldn't score. He only gave up 2 runs. That's usually good enough to win a game 9 times out of 10. So it's possible because both of those two teams have been pitching really well so far. It's just a matter of whether or not they can get more offense now and get themselves more comfortable leads.
Mike, it's been a pleasure having you on the last Sunday morning of Real Sports Talk Radio. It was hosted by myself.
Like,
I moved to Friday nights. What's that? Go ahead.
It's like the last episode of Cheers. The Islanders just scored again. You want to talk about mayhem right now. If this holds up, this flips the entire NHL script on its head. I mean, everybody just assumed Pittsburgh's going to roll through the Eastern Conference. Right now, this is dangerous right now. They're giving up a ton of odd man rushes to start this game. And we're 14 minutes still left in the first period, and the Islanders have a 2-0 lead. This, I don't know a single NHL guy that expected this.
Again, right now, Sidney Crosby needs to be the man. To be the man, you have to beat the man. And if the Islanders win, they have beaten the man.
Yeah, I agree. This is very interesting in terms of how this progresses because, like I said, Pittsburgh's a team that many just expected to roll right through the Eastern Conference and get to the Stanley Cup Finals in terms of all the players they got at the trade deadline, the scoring, Jerome Iginla. They still have Crosby and Neil and Malkin. They just assumed there's going to be – everybody just picked them to go right through the Eastern Conference. There wasn't a team, quote-unquote, that could beat them. Well, right now, they need to really step up their game because their defense has been really bad. It was really bad in the second part of Game 2 the other night. It's been horrendous to start today. They've been slow to everything. And I'm shocked, personally. I enjoy watching the Islanders. I'm a Devil fan, but I enjoy watching the Islanders because basically any team not the Rangers is a friend of mine. I'm shocked. Honestly, I'm shocked. The way that Game 1 went, the way Game 2 started, for the Islanders to have outscored Pittsburgh right now 6-0 in the last three and a half periods is shocking. Very shocking.
All right, my friend. It's been a great show. We will talk soon.
All right, man. Enjoy the rest of the day. Enjoy the basketball. I guess if you want to watch NBA TV, they're having the LeBron James press conference. So I don't know who would watch that with Memphis OKC going on. But you know what? If you want to do it, it's on 2:30.
You got it, brother. Thanks very much for a few minutes tonight.
All right. See you.
Be well. Mine's working fine. I only use the one that's in my room. It's not picking up.